It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around.
This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Well, the goal really was to make sure that somebody who had a serious medical condition, something beyond just a normal day-to-day illness like the flu, would not have their power or their water terminated without some accommodation. And so there was actually quite a bit of discussion and debate on how to define what a serious medical condition is. And the definition that finally came out in the rules encompasses, I think, most situations that we were hoping it would encompass.
Christy Mara, housing law attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, describes the literally life-saving new rules of the State Corporation Commission regulations that limit when an investor-owned electric utility, electric cooperative, or public utility providing water service can disconnect service to the home of a consumer with a serious medical condition. And we discuss other rules and lack thereof governing electric cooperatives during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 146, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Payday lenders prey on people in need, exploit lower and middle class America, and drain wealth from our communities. Here are just a few facts about payday lending in America today. Banks get loans from the government at 0%, they loan to payday lenders at 3%, and the payday lenders then loan to customers at 400%. There are an estimated 23,600 payday lender outlets in the United States, more than the number of McDonald's and Starbucks combined. Payday lenders are 2.5 times more likely to locate in African American and Latino communities, even when other factors like income are considered. Major payday lender chains receive their funding from the largest national banks. More than $1.5 billion in financing to major payday lenders is provided by major banks, including Wells Fargo, Bank of America, U.S. Bank, J.P. Morgan Bank, and National City Bank. All of these banks received TARP taxpayer bailout funds. For more information, go to http://showdowninamerica.org. In other news, rent-to-own companies are trying to imprison people for not paying on their rental contracts. But thankfully, the Court of Appeals of Virginia is not going along with this new version of debtor's prison. In the case of Tanisha Burt versus Commonwealth of Virginia, decided October 18, 2011, the consumer made only one payment and then couldn't be found. But the appeals court held there was no intent to defraud and reversed the criminal conviction for fraudulent conversion or removal of leased property. The court noted that the crime requires an intent to defraud. The consumer had agreed to pay $38 per week for 104 weeks for a total of $3,952 for a TV set and had not done so. However, an intent to defraud can't be proved beyond a reasonable doubt merely by showing that a consumer failed to honor the terms of the lease agreement. a person cannot be imprisoned, absent fraud, for mere failure to pay a debt arising from a contract. Although the evidence was sufficient to prove the customer breached her written lease agreement, the evidence failed as a matter of law to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she intended to defraud by failing to abide by the terms of the lease agreement. Accordingly, the appeals court reversed the conviction. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is West v. Costin. In 1979, six individual debtors filed a class action in federal court, alleging illegal debt collection practices by a debt collection agency and the agency president in violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. They claimed emotional distress resulting from the agency contacting third parties, threatening arrest, violating notice requirements, collecting unauthorized service charges, and misrepresenting debts. The debtors were awarded summary judgments on the third-party contact claims, arrest threat claims, notice claims, and the service charge claims, but were denied on the debt misrepresentation claim. The court granted the debtors summary judgment not only against the agency, but also against the agency's president personally, because the agency was undercapitalized and misused the corporate form. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and West v. Costin is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time once again for this week's question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Would you tell us your name and where you're from?
Alan Powhatan, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Alan. What question do we have this week?
I was calling about the public utilities, mainly in Powhatan. 90% of us, I would say, have electricity. And the companies that we are forced to use are either Dominion or, of course, Southside Electric Co-op. My question, sir, was who regulates the co-ops? I understand, like, for instance, Dominion Power, they would have to answer to the State Corporation Commission and this and that, but I'm not sure about the co-ops. Do they have to answer to anyone?
Well, Alan, the answer to that is no. They don't have to answer to anyone other than the members themselves, who presumably own and presumably get to direct the co-op. You're exactly correct that Dominion Power is regulated by the State Corporation Commission. There aren't a lot of regulations that are written down for the public utilities to follow, but they are regulated by the State Corporation Commission. And if customers of Dominion Power, or for that matter, if customers of any regulated utility, and that would be gas, electric, phone, or any regulated utility, water and sewer even, any regulated utility, if customers have problems, they can call the State Corporation Commission. There is a consumer complaint line, and locally that would be 804-371-9611. There's also a toll-free number for the State Corporation Commission, and that is 1-800-552-7945. But that only applies to regulated utilities. And with the exception of the State Corporation Commission's limitations on disconnection of electric and water service to customers with serious medical conditions, that took effect on October 31st, which we'll talk about later on in the show, co-ops are not regulated. And essentially, they are owned by the customers, and they are regulated really by the board of directors. So I really think that the complaint of any customer needs to be taken sort of up the chain of command to the administrative office of the co-op and then ultimately to the board of directors. Now, of course, one person making one individual complaint probably isn't going to have a lot of impact. But a lot of people bring in a complaint, especially to the board of directors, may have some impact. The problem, of course, with any public utility is that it is a monopoly. Obviously, if you're unhappy with the electric service that you're getting from Dominion or from the cooperative or whatever, you can't go to the other electric company like you can, for example, with internet or cable TV. There's just one provider. But the fact that there's one provider means that they should be responsive to your concerns. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. Thanks so much for being on the show. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, and we're talking with Christy Morrow, the housing law attorney, and we will be speaking about the new State Corporation Commission regulations that place limitations on disconnections of electric and water service in certain cases. Welcome to the show, Christy.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be here.
Now, Christy, will you tell our listeners, prior to these new regulations, what was the law on disconnection of electric and water service?
Well, the only law, really, regarding the disconnection of water and electric service was that you, and this is still the law, was that you have to get a notice at least 10 days prior to the disconnection, which is a notice of intent to terminate. Not, these new rules have not changed that, but in terms of how people with serious medical conditions were treated by the electric and water companies, there was nothing special set out for them in the regulations or in statute. Each utility company would create its own policy, sometimes on a case-by-case basis, about whether or not they were going to disconnect somebody for non-payment if that person had a serious medical condition.
But there was no generally recognized exception to that 10-day rule that was all they had to give you was the 10-day notice.
That's correct.
Now that's changed, I gather. So what utilities are included in this new change?
What is included in the new change are electric utility companies that are investor-owned, electric cooperatives, and public utilities providing water service.
So that would include things like Dominion Power, Old Dominion Power Company. It even includes those rural electric cooperatives?
Absolutely, yes.
And it would include, I guess, any public water utilities?
Yes.
Like City of Richmond?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And what customers or what conditions are covered by these new regulations that limit disconnection?
Well, the goal really was to make sure that somebody who had a serious medical condition, something beyond just a normal day-to-day illness like the flu, would not have their power or their water terminated without some accommodation. And so there was actually quite a bit of discussion and debate on how to define what a serious medical condition is. And the definition that finally came out in the rules encompasses, I think, most situations that we were hoping it would encompass. A serious medical condition is defined now in these rules as a physical or psychiatric condition that requires medical intervention to prevent further disability, loss of function, or death. And it goes on to say that these conditions are characterized by a need for ongoing medical supervision or the consultation of a physician. And I think what's key here is that there is no requirement that the serious medical condition require any particular equipment. There's no requirement that it require any particular medication, but simply that it is an ongoing medical condition that would worsen in the absence of this particular utility, whether it's water or electricity, and that it be certified by a physician.
So how is that certification done? How does a customer let the utility know that they or someone in their household has a, quote, serious medical condition?
Really very simple. There is a one-page form called the Serious Medical Condition Certification Form. It's available on the State Corporation Commission's website. So what the customer has to do is download a copy of that form, take it to the physician who is treating the household member with the serious medical condition, and have that physician fill it out. The physician, the customer whose name is on the bill, and the patient all have to sign that form. Now, once it's completed and signed, the customer simply files it with the utility company now.
And when can this serious medical condition certification form be given to the electric utility or the water utility?
It can be given really at any time. And let me tell you a couple of different scenarios. I think the best practice for people who qualify for this serious medical condition extension of power service or water service is to file it with the utility as soon as they get the form, before there's any problem with payment, before they fall behind. They don't have to do it that way, but that's the best way to do it, because in that event, they may still get that 10-day termination notice if they fall behind on their payments, but they can simply then call the utility company and say, I have a serious medical condition, you have the form already, and under the rules, at that time, the utility has to give them 30 days before they terminate.
What is the reason behind the 30 days? What's supposed to happen during that 30-day period?
During the 30-day period, the utility company is obligated to try to enter into a payment plan with the customer. And if they do enter into a payment plan, then they have to send a written copy of that plan to the customer so that the customer can review it and understand and know what the terms are. If they do not enter into a payment plan, they need to provide notice prior to the ultimate cutoff date of when that cutoff date will be, so a second notice, essentially, and a reminder that they could enter into a payment plan. There was a lot of discussion when these rules were being formed. There was a meeting held by the State Corporation Commission staff with all of the stakeholders to get our feedback. And there was a lot of discussion about payment plans and the possibility of not only allowing people more time to enter into a payment plan, but allowing them time to relocate with friends or relatives if they weren't able to enter into a payment plan. So the focus really was on making sure people with serious medical conditions weren't, you know, left in the dark after merely 10 days notice.
Was there any guidance at all provided as to what would be considered a reasonable payment plan, 3 months, 6 months, anything of that nature?
No. It's really going to be determined by each individual utility working with each individual customer. And it may be that somewhere down the road, the SEC revisits that issue and we see rules come out later about that, but there's no discussion about that now.
Okay, so you've described what happens if a customer who has a serious medical condition certification form on file gets a 10-day cutoff notice from an electric or water utility. Well, what happens if a customer has a household member who has a serious medical condition, but they haven't filed that certification form with the utility, and they get a 10-day cutoff notice? What can they do then? What should they do then?
Well, at that point, they should call their utility company and simply oral notification over the phone from a customer that they have a serious medical condition, even if they don't have the form on file, is enough to allow another 10-day delay.
What happened during that additional 10-day delay?
The utility company has to provide the customer with a copy or tell them how to access that serious medical condition form. Then the customer should get that completed by their physician, sent to the utility, and then that delay will be extended for the full 30 days.
So that 30 days would be in addition to the 10 days to get the certification form?
No, it includes the 10 days. But bear in mind that that 30 days is only really half of what the customer is entitled to. any consumer or customer with a serious medical condition and a form on file is entitled to 2 30-day delays over the course of a calendar year. Those 30-day delays can be consecutive. So you get a 60-day window. That's not a limit. That is a right. You're entitled to that 60-day window. The rules are very clear that the utility companies can give you as much time as they want.
Okay. Now, what would happen in a situation where a customer has a serious medical condition or the household member has a serious medical condition? They get the 10-day cutoff notice. For whatever reason, they don't notify the utility, or they're just not effective in notifying the utility, or they can't get the certification form completed by the physician, or they can't get it to the utility, and they get cut off. They lose electric power or they lose water service. What, if anything, can they do at that point?
Well, they can, at that point, get a serious medical condition form. They can notify the utility company, get a serious medical condition form, and file it. They have a 14-day window to do that, in which they then would get their power turned back on, or their water. And there can be no reconnect fee charged as a condition to having the utility turn the electricity or power back on. Utility can charge a reconnect fee, but later. They can do that later, as they would with a deposit, for example.
Right. And again, is there any limitation in the rules, either these rules or any other rules, on the amount of that reconnect fee?
No, there isn't. Except that the reconnect fee cannot be greater than whatever the normal fee is that that utility has in its tariffs on file with the SEC. So there are already some limits sort of self-imposed through the tariff process on reconnect fees, and they have to comply with those. There's no additional fee that they can charge.
Well, this sounds like a major improvement for utility customers who have serious medical conditions or have a household member with a serious medical condition. You mentioned this certification form that you said should be filed with the utility as soon as the customer knows of the need for it. How often does this form have to be filed with the utility? Is once enough, or does it have to be renewed periodically?
It needs to be renewed every 12 months.
And is the utility required to let the consumer know about that need to refile it every 12 months?
During the conversations that we had with the utility companies, they certainly gave the impression that they would be doing that.
Okay, well, that's very good. We have been speaking with housing law attorney Christy Mara at the Virginia Poverty Law Center about the new State Corporation Commission regulations that took effect on Monday, October the 31st. So these are in effect now, and they place limitations on disconnection of electric and water service to customers who have a serious medical condition, either themselves or anyone in their household. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 33.1, which deals with highways, bridges, and ferries. According to Code of Virginia Section 33.1-381, whenever the Commissioner of Highways determines that highway billboard gives incorrect information, the Commissioner shall notify the person who erected the billboard and the person on whose property it is located to remove it forthwith, and if not removed within 10 days, the Commissioner shall remove and destroy it without liability for damages. However, this past spring, Virginia was filled with billboards saying, Judgment Day, May 21st, 2011, the Bible guarantees it, with no report instance of the sign being torn down by the Highway Commissioner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli found no legal basis for Virginia colleges to protect people based on sexual orientation and gender identity. But did he consider everything? Join us next week when former Chief Deputy Attorney General Claire Guthrie Gastaniaga points out the many sources of law that were overlooked and which grant legal protection to gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgendered persons in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on April 14, 2010. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. My Lord.